Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we ask brilliant educators everything you've ever wondered about teaching English language learners. I'm your host, Liesl Koop. I'm an ENL teacher and resource specialist with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us. Okay, everybody, welcome back. Thank you for coming back for another episode of Our Burning Questions. We have two really important questions that our conversation is going to focus on today. Our first question is, how can we as teachers and administrators best support the multilingual families in our communities during distance learning, and really all the time? And the second question is, how can teachers create learning environments that cultivate multilingualism, even if their districts don't have bilingual or dual language programs? I'm so excited to get to have this conversation with our very special guest today. If you are following any kind of dual language programming or bilingual education resource sharing on Twitter, you definitely are following our special guest today, Dr. Jose Medina. Welcome, Dr. Medina.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited. As I was mentioning right before we started recording, it's a thrill for me anytime that anyone gives me an opportunity to share resources and information that will better serve our emergent multilingual students. So gracias.
Thank you. I just think that you have such a powerful and special way of sharing a message that's so critical for teachers. In particular, right now in the environment that we're teaching in, where teachers are working with students that they've never worked with before. And I am so appreciative of the way that you show up in real life and online to share a really important message. So thank you for what you do.
No, thank you. I mean, I think one of the things that for me is imperative is to share what I do know, not only as an educator, but the fact that I was one of the students that often is left behind, I think pushes me to really be assertive in a very lovely bombazo kind of way with humor, but to really speak truth to power. So I feel like it's the reason I wake up in the morning. So I'm glad that the messages resonate with educators.
Yeah, that's exactly how I would describe how you present in the world, is just like sharing such an important and sometimes uncomfortable message without making people feel judged. And I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Gracias, gracias.
So for those who may not be familiar with you and your work, can you tell us what your title is, what your job is right now? What are your special areas of interest or research?
Sure. So prior to starting my own boutique educational consulting company almost 2 years ago, I was a research scientist at the Center for Applied Linguistics here in the Washington, D.C. area. For those of you that are not familiar with Cal, it's one of the major think tanks in the world in terms of serving newcomer, refugees, SIFs, LIFE, dual language learners. I say that knowing that labels are one of the things that we need to work on, but it was an amazing opportunity to serve there. I still can't believe how someone with my background actually ended up at one of the major think tanks in the world, but I was collaboratively guiding all of that work in terms of research, but also professional development with the team that I served with. Prior to that, I was a teacher, an assistant principal, a principal, and also a district leader. But now I guide a team of 15 dual language experts from around the country and internationally. And we serve all over the United States and abroad, really helping teachers, but also principals and leaders to better serve our students. Because the truth is that for the longest time, we really haven't done a good job about in terms of serving our emergent multilingual students. And so that's really the goal. I think the other thing that makes our team different is that we are really overt in our focus on equity and social justice. And so all of our professional development, all of our research really is facilitated and delivered through that lens, where people are going to feel uncomfortable. But I think that they're also going to be glad to move forward in their work, because all of us are good people. I mean, I've met very few educators that are not good people. So sometimes the things that we do that are culturally destructive are because we just lack the information. And so that's what I do now. Again, I cannot even believe que esta es mi vida, ¿verdad? Que tengo la oportunidad de guiar en nuestro equipo, but I'm just so humbled by the opportunity that schools and districts really have created for our team so that we can serve.
Thank you for sharing that. And we will definitely, at the end of the episode, talk a little bit about where people can find you and your team and where they can read more about all the work that you do.
Perfect.
So you've referenced or alluded a little bit to your story and your past, and that's kind of where I would like to start our conversation. So when we're talking about supporting multilingual families, I think we have to talk about testimonios, like you always talk about on your social media. Would you be willing to share your testimonio about your family's experience with the schooling system?
Sure. So testimonial work is so integral for students in any educational setting. Testimonials really are that student's life story, that family's life story. And by allowing those testimonials to come into the educational space, in essence, we are creating a pathway to dismantling systems of oppression that have been there. My personal testimony, I think, has resonated with people because both my mom and my dad had very limited opportunities in terms of formal education. And so mi papá, he only went up to the fifth grade in Ciudad Juárez, Chihuahua. That's where he's from. My mom also from Ciudad Juárez. And so she was able to go as far as the sixth grade. They got married pretty young and had me in their late teens, early 20s. And really they wanted the American dream for me. And so as their firstborn, they crossed from Juarez to El Paso, Texas. I'm from El Paso. And that's where we kind of set up our home and began our search for the American dream. When I started school, I only spoke Spanish. And so I got to experience firsthand some of that discrimination, prejudice, and bias that happens to kids even today, because all of those things are still prevalent. In those days, though, it was a little bit tougher in that teachers could actually physically restrain or physically hurt you if you were a language learner who didn't speak English and somehow, were trying to make connections through your first language. I actually was taken to kindergarten and I was a really nervous child. And so I actually kicked and punched and peed on myself and would run out of the school. That went on for a couple of weeks. And I actually got kicked out of kinder. My mom and my dad were told that I needed to mature. So I skipped kinder. They took me back to that same school as a first grader. And this is in El Paso Independent School District. And I work with them really closely. So they know that I share my testimonio. And I'm so blessed and grateful for the opportunity to return to that district as an adult to help guide their work, which is amazing. But in those days, that principal kicked me out again as a first grader because I did the same thing. And Lau versus Nichols, the U.S. Supreme Court case, had already come down, but it hadn't made its way yet really into schools. And so my mom and my dad, not knowing the language and being so embarrassed that their firstborn child was not wanting to stay in school, left without any fight. So they didn't advocate for me. My godmother had been in the United States a little bit longer. And so she told my parents to take me to the Moncas. The Moncas are the nuns. And so they took me to St. Patrick's Elementary School in El Paso, Texas. And on my first day as a first grader there, I did the same thing. I punched, I kicked, I tried to run away. The nun who was a principal told my mom and my dad to hold me down as they brought in a gurney from the nurse's office. And so my mom and my dad, really trusting the educational system, physically held me down as the principal strapped me onto the gurney. And I've shared this in some keynotes that I've given, like, to this day, the one thing my parents cannot talk about is that experience because they feel such guilt. And I've told them that they were just doing the best that they could. They trusted the educational system, but I still could see them, as they were rolling me into the first grade classroom in a puddle of my own urine, my mom and my dad completely devastated and not knowing what to do. to top it all off, the teacher said, you know, we have a new student, welcome him to our class. His name is Joe. And so not only was I rolled into that classroom on a gurney and tied up, but my name was changed to Joe. And my mom said, do whatever the teacher says. So at school, my name became Joe. And at home, my name was Junior, because my dad's name is also Jose. So I was Junior. And it wasn't until my 20s and even into my 30s that I was trying to come to terms with what had happened to me, and finally said, what the hell happened? And so I started owning back the name that my mom had taught me at home. And so my full name is El Dr. José Luis Medina Hernández Franco López Junior Díaz Cruz. As you know, I use that every time that I have a hashtag Medina Monday message on social media every Monday, because it's a way to really amplify the voices of the many language learners that are still struggling today, and that we're seeing the evidence of that so much more even right now during COVID-19 guidelines. But yeah, that's why my work is everything to me, because I know that the children are still being oppressed in U.S. school systems.
I feel so many emotions listening to you. There's so much going on in my body and my mind as I'm listening to your story. And thank you for being willing to share that. And thank you for re-owning who you are and what is important, which is you. I really appreciate you being willing to share that, not just with me, but with everybody, because you do. That's really powerful. And I think that maybe not every English learner's experience is the same, but there is still a level of trauma that kids are experiencing when we aren't inviting them in and welcoming them into our schools in a way that makes them feel valued. So I'm really grateful that you shared that. Thank you.
No, you're welcome. I mean, I always share with educators that we are still tying kids to gurneys. They just are metaphorical straps rather than physical ones. Mm-hmm. But the moment that a child that doesn't speak English comes into the school system, if the first question is, how are we going to get him or her or them to transition to English so that they can pass standardized state assessments? Like, that's the moment that we tie kids to gurneys. The moment that a teacher gets a child in their classroom and runs to the EAL or the ENL or the ESOL teacher and says, help me, how are we going to fix this child? Like, that's the moment that we tie kids to gurneys, even if we didn't realize it. And so that's the message. Like, we're still doing it. It's just in a different form, in a different fashion.
I think that's really a powerful wake-up call. And like you said earlier, it's not because we're bad people, it's because we need information that we haven't had yet.
Yeah.
Before this sudden move to virtual learning that we've all had to navigate, what were some best practices you saw in action that gave multilingual families access to monolingual school settings?
Yeah, so I want to tell the listeners that there are amazing things happening in schools across the country. There are schools that actually engage in conversations about the fact that most of what we do in U.S. schooling was designed and created to elevate and amplify the voices of white middle-income families. And so most of what is still happening today prior to COVID-19 was all about really ensuring that that monolingual, monocultural, patriarchal system of education remains the status quo. And there are schools and districts that have actually said hell to the no. And so they are working on sociocultural competence, where every single educator, parent, and child are talking about the fact that we all are a big mess, but what are the things that we do? What are the tools that we can use to catch ourselves in our own privilege, in our own bias, to really be defenders of equity and social justice for others? I have to tell you that there are like 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds around the country that if you ask them, like, Oyes, ¿y por qué estás en el programa dual? Like, why are you in this dual language program, for example? They'll say, porque soy defensor de la equidad. Like, four-year-olds, because teachers are doing the hard work of actually engaging them in conversations that go beyond the superficial. It's so interesting because a lot of schools say that they're culturally responsive. A lot of administrators say that they're servant leaders. But I don't think that a lot of us really understand what that looks like, because it isn't about a multicultural night. It is about embedding equity and social justice into everything that we do. That means going out into the community and actually reaching parents in a way that is easy for them to understand. We can't expect parents to always come to us. Sometimes we need to bring down those walls ourselves and go into the community and serve. And so prior to COVID-19, I would always ask school leaders and teachers, when was the last time that you went knocking on someone's door and said, hola, ¿cómo están? ¿Qué le vengo a decirles que vamos a tener una junta? Are you gonna come? Because people tell me that you're not gonna show up to the meetings, but I know that they're liars. Here's the pamphlet. Do you know what I mean? Like, when was the last time that you did that? When was the last time that you got your phone out and you did a Facebook Live just to say hello to your community? Because parents will show up if we create a space that is actually inclusive. And if they don't show up, it's not because they don't care. It's because you probably aren't that welcoming as a school. I mean, think about my parents. My parents never showed up to schools, not because they didn't believe in education, which we often say about our marginalized communities and families. Oh, it's just that they don't value education. And really what we're saying is they don't align to my middle income white way of thinking about education, because my parents are the biggest educational advocates. They were just busting their butts working multiple jobs to ensure that I had some type of entry into that access. You know what I mean? And so that's the reality. But there's that positive note, because I can think of right now, there's a school in San Antonio where right now, even during COVID-19, the principal and the teachers are out in the community using whatever technological method they know their parents can access so that they can connect with those families, including the kids. I'm thinking of a school in California where the parents and the grandparents are joining in on the lessons through Zoom, and the teachers are modifying and are instructing anyone who's in front of the screen. I mean, those are the kinds of things that really should have been happening prior to COVID-19, but that now really have become evident in terms of the disparities when it comes to Black, Indigenous students of color. Sorry, I get passionate.
Don't say sorry.
People can't see me, but you can see me. I'm like, así, bien animado, bien animated.
Please don't apologize, because it's what we need to hear, and it's what we need to feel in order to move in the direction that our students and their families deserve. As you were talking, I was thinking about a lot of the schools and districts that we support through our organization. And we have a really unique region because we have several areas that have large numbers of multilingual families. And then we serve a lot of districts that have one or two multilingual learners, or very small numbers of multilingual learners. And I think that there is a fear that is in and grows in educators who are not experienced working with multilingual learners and their families. And I think they want to do things that make families feel comfortable. What would you say to teachers who say, like, I'm afraid, or I don't speak Spanish, or I don't speak Arabic? How can I possibly, like, go to somebody's door and say, like, hey, are you coming, if I don't speak their language? What would you say to them?
I would say to them that you don't have to be multilingual to be an advocate for all children. Like, some of the best dual language teachers, some of the best bilingual teachers, some of the best teachers that serve in monolingual settings but really are able to reach those communities that we should be reaching out to more. It doesn't matter. Like, there are some people that are multilingual who are the worst advocates for multilingual learners. Some of us that are Latino are the worst in terms of supporting programs that really help the Latino community. And so some of the best support people and advocates out there are white, heterosexual, fabulous educators, because what it takes is having a good heart and really doing the work of sociocultural competence and critical consciousness. And so when you engage in those two pieces, sociocultural competence, meaning that we see the similarities and the differences in each other, but we see the differences as ways to connect rather than obstacles to overcome. And critical consciousness, understanding that we are indeed a biased and prejudicial educational system, then our job is to help dismantle those systems to create access for others. And anyone can do that work. I have to tell you something. So when I was a principal, we had a family that that was Muslim, and the mom didn't speak as much English. She spoke a little bit of English, was awesome in terms of multilingualism. But in English, she was still adding to her linguistic repertoire. And I didn't know a lot about the Muslim religion at that moment, but one of the teachers said, you cannot touch her. You're very touchy, Medina. Don't touch her because her husband's gonna get really mad. And I did a lot of research on the Muslim religion. And I have to tell you that after that family got to know my heart, the husband was pushing her towards me. And he was like, abrazar, you know what I mean? And so if students and families can feel your heart, then at the core, really that's what's important. The other thing that I would say is that research in terms of how to serve language learners or emergent multilingual students, the research and the strategies are the same. And so if I'm willing to learn the latest research in terms of how to leverage everything that a student brings into the space, then I am absolutely the best person to co-create that educational access with my students, with the students that I serve.
That's encouraging. And I think that our listeners will really appreciate that, because there is a lot of fear and uncertainty and lack of knowledge about how to interact with people who are different from us, especially in areas that have, you know, historically only served white monolingual English speaking students. So
definitely. Yeah, we can all do the work. And luckily for us, sociocultural competence and critical consciousness isn't just about language. I mean, it's about amplifying the voices of many communities, the LGBTQ plus community, focusing on diverse religious beliefs, focusing on legal status, on gender inequity, focusing on physical abilities or the lack thereof. Like, sociocultural competence is really about getting to the heart of any individual and making those connections. And so that's work that all of us can engage in. But in order to engage in that work, we first have to acknowledge the fact that we have been complicit in solidifying the status quo through a monolingual, monocultural, patriarchal system of education. I'm going to repeat that a couple of times because it's important that I get it out there, Verda.
Good. And I think I can only speak from my own experience as a white educator, but that is uncomfortable and that feels bad, and I still have to do it.
We have to do it.
So I just want our listeners to know, like, yeah, it's not supposed to feel good when you realize things that you've done that have been actually harmful to kids that you're trying to serve, and you can do better. So
I want you to know that I'm a part of the problem too. Like, I'm guilty. Like, I could have done better when I was a teacher, and I could have done better when I was an administrator. And there were pieces of research that I was not aware and privy to at the moment. And so all of us really have to continue the work. So sociocultural competence isn't like an end, like the work of really acknowledging what a big mess we are. Like, that happens every day, but there are tools that will help us. So for example, when I say something biased, or something that I immediately realize is subtractive in nature, like, I actually ask myself four reflection questions. I ask myself, who are you? Who are you not? What do you believe in? What do you need to do? Who are you? Who are you not? What do you believe in? What do you need to do? Who are you? Who are you not? What do you believe in? What do you need to do? ¿Quién eres? ¿Quién no eres? ¿Qué crees? ¿Qué tienes que hacer? ¿Quién eres? ¿Quién no eres? ¿Qué crees? ¿Qué tienes que hacer? And that immediately kind of centers me, so that when I do say something subtractive or something that is culturally destructive, that's one of my go-to tools to rectify the situation in a moment. And so I want your listeners to understand that I make many, 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 many mistakes every day. I just happen to have a couple of tools that help me catch myself in the moment and say, No manches, way, which the audience can't, the listeners can't see, but I actually slapped the top of my hand there. Like, I'm like, what did you just think or say? Because we all have bias.
I love that. That's such a great strategy too. I think, you know, it feels uncomfortable to be called out. And if we can start practicing that with ourselves and really calling ourselves in to look more closely at that, I think that's such a great strategy. And I think it's so easy to apply.
Yeah. And sharing with our kids, look, we're going to do this hard work and we're all going to make mistakes. And I'm going to be the biggest mistake of all, but we're all going to call upon each other so that in collaborative fashion, we can all grow together. And I think that just makes it so much easier. And again, I want to stress to the listeners that there are people doing this hard work all around the country.
Oh, that's encouraging. We've talked about this a little bit, and maybe you can expand upon it more, because I think as a white educator, it's been a challenge for me to take myself out of the center of a conversation. So how can monolingual English-speaking educators amplify the voices of multilingual families and not just assume we know what families need and want?
Absolutely. So I think that one of the things that really was a shift for me is when I came to understand that the lesson planning process is a political act. So let me say that again. The lesson planning process is a political act. And when we continue to lesson plan through a monolingual, monocultural, and patriarchal system of education, then we in essence become the oppressors. And so for me, that was really, really important to really own, because I had been lesson planning and asking others to lesson plan through that lens. One of the things that has been really amazing about going out on my own, and I have to tell you, just as a side note, because, you know, we've gotten to chat a little bit today, I feel like I can share this with you. Like, that was frightening to leave the comfort of a steady job and to leave the comfort of serving in a major entity in the world of research. But the one thing that it did when I decided to gamble on me was that it really opened the door to really be creative in terms of how to lesson plan. And so one of the things that I'm really proud of is that for the last 2 years, as I've served around the country, that's been the biggest, I think, gift that I've been able to share, is a different way of thinking about our lessons. And the way that happens is really to do it through that sociocultural competence lens. And so as we lesson plan, there are four things that we should keep in mind, whether we're in a monolingual setting, whether we're in a world language setting, whether we're in a heritage language setting, in an immersion setting, or in a dual language setting, and whether it's face-to-face or right now that we're lesson planning via remote learning, which really is more than remote learning. It's learning in crisis and facilitating instruction in crisis. But the four themes are: one, is this lesson that I've planned, is it amplifying the voice of a marginalized community? Two, am I allowing students to make connections to real world or to their own lives? Three, am I allowing students to make cross-linguistic connections? That's not just for multilingual students that feel most comfortable just in English. Am I allowing them to learn beyond just English, even in a monolingual setting? And then the fourth one is, am I really allowing kids to understand that there is no hierarchy in language? Social and academic language are equally important. And so I think that if we take those four pieces through every lesson that we plan, then we really are working towards that sociocultural competence.
That is really powerful. I think that as an ENL teacher, we have always kind of focused on this social language versus academic language. And I really appreciate you bringing up that last point, because that is a really culturally embedded idea that I never thought of that way. I really appreciate you bringing that up.
It's been really a part of the C6 by Literacy framework, is the framework that our team conceptualized. And it's not a to-do list. It just identify six pieces that really should be a part of every lesson. And it doesn't happen every day, but you're conscious of it, so that when you're lesson planning, you really are thinking of yourself as that defender of equity and social justice. And one of the pieces that there's been a little bit of pushback has been this idea of there is no hierarchy in language. Mm-hmm. And the example that I always use is that, you know, if I showed up to my mom's house, or if I were FaceTiming her, and my mom and my dad still speak only Spanish, because they're awesome. Mm-hmm. If I spoke to them, and what good is it for me to use words like translanguaging and cognitive dissonance if it's not the appropriate context? And so my job as a teacher, regardless of educational setting, is not to get rid of things that are a part of the student's repertoire, linguistic or cultural repertoire. My job is to value it, sustain it, and then help them expand that repertoire. And so if a student says sup or asks instead of asks, then my job is not to say, you don't say asks, which we did to our Black community and Black students forever and ever. What you would have wanted to say, if we knew better, is if a student said asks, then we would have said, oh, I love that you say asks. You know, the research actually supports that as African-American language. That's awesome. So what I need to help you do is add asks, so that depending on the context, you're able to mobilize it. Or kids that say bols or mucho in Spanish, we have teachers that facilitate instruction in Spanish that will like jump on a kid and say, no se dice así, because, you know, we too are haters and have bias in our heart and are good people who just didn't know better. But our job is not to destroy the mucho. Our job is to say, oh, tú dices mucho. Mi mamá también a veces dice mucho, pero lo que vamos a hacer es que vamos a mantener, a sostener el mucho y le vamos a agregar mucho para que dependiendo del contexto, puedas movilizarlo. Depending on the context, you can mobilize whatever it is that you need.
I love that.
That's the difference.
Right. That is just knowing the kid, which I think is what it comes down to. And like you said, expanding their repertoire of linguistic and non-linguistic tools to pull from. I love it.
Yeah.
We have talked about this already, my next question, but let's try to get a little bit more specific maybe. What sure. role does self-reflection play for teachers who are monolingual English speakers and work with multilingual families?
So I think that the reflection is for the teachers that you described in that question, but really it's for all of us. The question is, how am I going to change what I've always done in order to truly create access to educational opportunity for every single child? The bottom line is that whether you are serve in a monolingual setting or serve in a bilingual or multilingual setting, like all of us have to reflect, because as I mentioned, all of us have to do the work. I have to say that to your monolingual listeners. If you're monolingual and fabulous, then reflect. If you're multilingual and fabulous, then reflect, because you're just as big of a mess. And so if all of us are reflecting together, then maybe we can change the course of the work that we're doing and really do something that's different and outside the box. But that's not going to happen without acknowledging what we've done in the past.
Where are there opportunities right now for deeper connections between school and families?
So I think that I touched upon it, but I really believe that if you ground, if you use sociocultural competence and critical consciousness as the foundation of everything that happens in a school, then the work is going to get done. Because the way that you really allow families to feel like they're a part of your community is if you're actually engaged in that work. I have to tell you that sometimes you don't even think of these things, but from the moment that you walk into a school, you know if it's an inclusive community or not. I remember being in Westchester Bozies, and we did a face-to-face training there. And one of the things that kind of rocked their world is I said, why do we sometimes hire the meanest people to be in the front office? Because hashtag la mera neta, hashtag la true, because from the moment that a family walks into the school building, you either feel like you want to jump for joy or you feel like you want to run out the door. That has to do with two big pieces, how welcoming the front office staff, but ultimately the school takes on the personality of the principal and the leadership team. And so if you walk into a school and you want to die, that's the principal. If you go into a school and you want to dance, that's the principal. I love doing PD for principals because having been a principal, I'm like, no manchen, I know how to create a master schedule and give you strategies. So don't act like I'm just some researcher facilitator. So I think those things are really, really important. How the front office really is receptive to the families that come in. And then how the administrators really model that sociocultural competence. And I'm sorry, but I'm also going to say, like, we need to be very, very cognizant of the fact that most of the district leadership and campus leadership still continues to be white, male, and heterosexual. Like, I don't understand that. I have some amazing colleagues that are white, male, and heterosexual, but if you're white, male, and heterosexual, without even working on it, you inherited the trifecta of privilege. And what that means is that if you have those three privileges, your responsibility is to use that privilege to create pathways to that privilege for every other person that you come in contact with. So just, you know, that's a little side note, but I thought it was a little bombazo that needed to be said, and it connected to the question.
It did. It did. I appreciate it.
I'm a big mess.
So thinking about all the recommendations and the tools for self-reflection and building social cultural competence, when we don't provide true access to school communities for multilingual families, what are we missing out on? What are the consequences?
Well, we're going to continue to keep students from really doing the work starting from a young age. And so basically we're perpetuating what has always existed. I mean, one of the things that was exciting for me as a biliteracy instructional coach, AKA a dual language principal, was really to ensure that the community was a part of everything that we did. And so, like, I can give you some specific examples. Every school, whether you're at the elementary, middle school, or high school, I've done elementary, middle school, and high school, you need to have parent input into the community, into the committee that really helps you with a campus improvement plan. Well, what happens with those committees is that usually it's somebody not representative of the Black Indigenous community. They're usually English speaking. And so without thinking about it, we've already created a system to ensure that only certain parents are gonna participate. For us, it was imperative that we had PTO or PTA parents that either were just Spanish speaking or fully bilingual. And we set that right up front. In our PTA meetings, we not only shared information about baking cupcakes and sales, we actually, every PTA and PTO meeting had some kind of piece in terms of sociocultural competence so that the parents understand that they're a big hot mess and that sometimes they're the ones that continue to perpetuate that at home. Because if you're doing that work at school, but it doesn't make its way to the home, then you're losing an opportunity there as well. Everything really should be in multiple languages. What are the three or four languages that are represented most on your school, whether dual language, bilingual, or monolingual setting? And then ensuring that that's represented. Like, you can walk into any building and really know whether others are valued or not. Do we have an LGBTQ rainbow symbol in every door? Do we have different posters of different religions and people of different colors, different backgrounds represented? Like, all of those things are the things that are going to make sure that that those families feel included. Are you doing your meetings in multiple languages? Like, one of my favorite things to do, like, I'm lucky because I'm fully bilingual, so all of our meetings were in both languages. But for example, if you only speak English, why can't you ask one of your Spanish speakers, one of your multilingual speakers, to do the entire meeting in Spanish? And then force your parents that speak English to wear the headphones so that they receive translation. That sends a message. And I'm telling you that parents, if you establish that community, your parents that come from tons of privilege, they will demand more. Because once they know they want to do better. And so the parents will be like, this month, it's my turn to hear some translation, and they'll be happy for it.
I love that flip of, you know, putting somebody on the opposite side that they haven't experienced.
Well, and we have to say it out loud, right? Like for my principals and assistant principals out there, just like our teachers, we need to be willing to say out loud and in front of parents and in front of district leadership and in front of teachers, like, we have screwed over our Black Indigenous students of color. What are we going to do about it? Mm-hmm. And at that moment, the teachers that are unwilling to do the work, or the principals that might be unwilling to do the work, then they'll have a decision to make, because is this the community that I want to be a part of or not? And I say to teachers every day, if you're not willing to do this work, I'm not going to judge you. We can still be Facebook friends, but I need you to get the hell out of the school where I'm serving so that you can make space for someone that is willing to do the work.
I think that's powerful. We get asked questions a lot. We facilitate a professional learning session on New York's culturally responsive sustaining education framework. And we get a lot of really thoughtful and introspective participants. And one thing they're always asking is, well, what do we do with the people who just aren't there, who just don't want to do it? And I appreciate the fact that you're just so direct about, like, it's okay if you're not there. You just can't be here with kids if that's how it's going to be. And that's a hard message to send. And I think that it hasn't been sent in the past. So
I tell my principal and assistant principal friends, district leader friends, that our job is to be coaches. And so if I have, if I serve a teacher as principal, and she, he, or they are having trouble really coming to terms with owning how we really have not done well by some student groups, then my job as a principal, as a leader, is to coach and coach and coach and coach, because you want to be able to offer those tools. And I have to tell you that in almost my 25 years of experience, most of the teachers, most of the leaders, most educators are going to be coachable. But if there is that one that doesn't see that there's a problem, that wants to maintain the status quo, then after I've coached and coached and coached you, then my job is to document, 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 so that at the end of our time together, you'll know and realize that this was not the space for you, and that that's okay. We're just on a different journey. So coach, coach, coach. But if the coaching is not working, then document, document, document. We'll be friends on Instagram.
Thank you. I'd like to kind of transition into our second question of today, which revolves around creating multilingual supportive environments, even when districts don't have dual language or bilingual programs. Because in our region here, around the Syracuse, New York area, we have very few bilingual education or dual language programs. What is your advice for sustaining and growing the few programs that we do have here?
So we definitely, for the dual language and bilingual programs that are already implementing, we need to make sure that those teachers and those administrators have the tools to really align with the most recent recommendations in terms of research and biliteracy instructional practices. I have to tell you that everyone out there is trying to do their best, but there are some basic things that haven't been as widespread as they should be. So for example, for those of those listeners that are in bilingual or dual language programs, actually, even if you're in a monolingual program, I would ask, have you read the Guiding Principles for Dual Language Education, third edition? It's a free resource. It's the resource that is most commonly used, not only in the United States, but across the world, to implement bilingual and dual language programming. And not only should you have read that resource, which was, the third edition was released in November of 2017, so it includes all of the latest in terms of recommendations, but you should have it tabbed, and you should be referencing it. And you should actually, as a team, be looking at one or two of the rubrics in there and working on that for the school year. One of the things that I love about the resource is that it's divided into three sections. One is a literature review for each of the seven strands. So the strands are program structure, curriculum, instruction, assessment, professional development and staffing, family and community, and then support and resources. And so if you have a question about assessment in a bilingual program, you just go to strand number four, assessment, and you have 5 to 7 pages of the latest research for assessment in a dual language programs. If you have a question about translanguaging, you go to strand number three, instruction, and you have 5 to 7 pages with the latest information on biliteracy instructional practices, including translanguaging information. So it's just everything that you could want as that initial step in one resource. The other piece is a lot of us in dual language and bilingual education are still under the idea that we have two monolingual programs basically working side by side. And that's aligned with older research. And by older, I mean like over a decade, right? And so there are still some dual language bilingual programs that have monolingual English time, monolingual Spanish time, for example, or Mandarin or Portuguese, whatever the partner language is, and the two shall never meet. Well, that's crazy, because basically what you end up having, you're not working on bilingualism and biliteracy. You have two monolingual programs side by side calling each other a dual or a bilingual program. What we know now is that really we have to plan for cross-linguistic connections so that the kids are able to really make those connections and understand the content in both languages. I was in a classroom in California before COVID-19, and I think it was like a third grade classroom, because I do a lot of coaching with administrators where I actually walk the classrooms with administrators and I tell them, oh, look, this is a really strong bridge level one anchor chart, or this is a regionalismo anchor chart. This is awesome. Or, oh, look, she has a word wall in Spanish. We really need to fix that because word walls don't exist in Spanish. We could do something different. And we were in a classroom and I saw that the teacher was doing a whole group teach, and she was saying the word residuo. It was a facilitation in Spanish. And I was like, residuo, residual. Like, I'm making those connections in my head. I was like, what the hell is a residuo? So I asked one of the kids, I was like, oye, ¿qué es un residuo? And he was a little smart aleck kid. I love him. He was like, look at the anchor chart. I'm like, all right. In my head, like, back down. And so I looked at the anchor chart. Residuo is remainder. But you know what? I wasn't in a dual language program. And so that escaped me. And so if I'm supposed to do some kind of math problem solving and the word residuo comes up, I'm going to be stuck, because I was a part of either a monolingual or two monolingual side-by-side programs that isn't really a true dual language program. And so some teachers are really hesitant to make cross-linguistic connections. And I hear things like, Jose, but they'll wait until I use the other language. And I'm like, not if you're doing this right, people. Are you using the 4+1 language domains? Do the kids own their language learning targets? Because then really the kids can make the connections. Imagine, I'm 48 years old, even though I look 38, and I didn't know the word residuo. That's cray cray. Somebody along the line did not cross-linguistically help me make those connections. So I think those two things, read the guiding principles and align to the latest research that really shows us that cross-linguistic work has to be planned for. I'm not saying that the kids get to talk in whatever language they want. We have to align, but we also need to plan for the specific work that allows them to leverage their entire linguistic repertoire. So the two themes, keep in mind.
That's really cool. And just quickly, I was realizing as you were talking about the different kinds of programs that maybe some of our listeners don't know what the difference is between a bilingual program, a dual language program, a transitional bilingual. Can you just quickly explain to them what the different kinds of programs are?
Sure. So one of the things that I always like to do with educators is walk them from the most subtractive to the most additive or culturally sustaining programs that we use to serve language learners, emergent multilinguals in the United States. So submersion programs are when kids don't get any type of support. That's like me being tied to a gurney, but it's still happening because if a parent denies services because they don't have the right information, then this kid that needs the linguistic support gets none. So that's the lowest. ESL pullout, is right next to that. ESL Pullout, or ENL, I think is what you call it in New York. So ENL Pullout programs, especially when they're not aligned with what's happening in the core classes, that's very subtractive. That doesn't mean that if you're an ENL teacher, you're subtractive. It means that you're working within a subtractive system. So if I'm an ENL pullout teacher, then I need to be as additive as possible and say, I love that you're a French speaker. Je peux parler français un peu. And focus on adding rather than transitioning, right? And also making sure that I'm aligned with the core content teachers. ESL or ENL pullout. Obviously, I'm sorry, push in is the next level. That's when the teacher, the ENL teacher, pushes in to provide support. Early exit transitional bilingual is when we give students access to home language. In this case, we can say Spanish, for example, but we want to transition the kids by first, second grade, sometimes even third. That's an early exit. Late exit transitional, same kind of program. I'm going to hook you up with your native language, but just until fourth or fifth, because then I need to get you ready for middle school, whatever that means. Still transitional. And then the only additive model is dual language education, because in dual language education, when done well, it really is about sustaining and expanding what the students bring into the space. The other thing that I will say for dual language, though, because some people may not know the difference between dual language one way and two way. Dual language one way really is exactly the same as dual language two way in terms of the strategies and the research. What makes dual language one way and two way different is the student composition. So in a dual language one way program, you may have more students like me that are most comfortable with Spanish upon entry into the school system. And I still follow the same three goals of dual language and the research. In a dual two-way program, what we do is we try to leverage by bringing in kids that feel most comfortable in English, kids that feel most comfortable in Spanish or Chinese or Portuguese, depending on the program, and really using both sets of students to really help them engage and model each of the two program languages. The only thing to remember is that we cannot be biased in dual language two-way programs, because one thing that is happening is that dual language two-way programs are becoming gentrified. And so in dual language two-way programs, often we get very excited when a white student is bilingual, is becoming bilingual and biliterate, and we'll be like, oh my God, Tiffany said something amazing in Spanish. But right next to Tiffany might be, you know, I don't know, Fernando, Amar, and they certainly don't get the praise with them. We immediately want to implement some kind of intervention. And so that's happening all over the United States. Something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I joke with district leaders that whenever they hear a young child in a kinder class in a two-way program kind of practicing their Spanish, yo puedo hablar español poquito, el hombre es bueno. And like, we get excited and we bring the cameras and like we take a videotape, you know, we record that. And that's what goes on the BOSI's website or the district website, the white kid speaking in Spanish. But Fernando is in the background in intervention being pulled out during core instruction. And so it's crazy that we continue to be the only country where somehow English monolingualism is the route that we want for our kids that are already multilingual as they come in to the system.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a wake-up call for anybody who has seen any kind of bilingual programming. I think just to be aware that can happen, and we can't dismantle an inequitable system by using inequitable tactics that we've always been using.
Well, and dual language at the core is for our students that are language learners. And we need to be able to say that in a two-way program. Like, we need to say to the parents, even those that come from privilege, like, this program, first and foremost, is about creating access for the kids that we have screwed over. We are just lucky that the research tells us that we can bring in kids that feel most comfortable in English so that they can be language models for each other. But don't get it twisted, parents. In this school, we're gonna have some meetings in Espanol, and you're gonna have to wear the little translation devices. You're welcome. You're gonna grow so much. Like, we need to be willing to say that.
Yeah, I love that. For the teachers in our region, we hear questions like the next one a lot. We don't have any books or apps or programs for my students who speak Arabic or Gujarati or whatever language the students speak. How can I cultivate multilingualism if my school doesn't have multilingual resources?
So it depends on the setting, right? If you're facilitating instruction in a monolingual setting, and you're trying to work on sociocultural competence and critical consciousness, no one is expecting you to have math content every day in the partner language, because it might not exist. But what we can do in a monolingual setting is look for things, make connections, use social media. So much is actually out there available that we can bring into the classroom. I also would leverage what parents and what students bring in. I'm thinking of a classroom. It's a monolingual setting in a school that I serve in Beijing, China. And this fourth grade teacher, monolingual English speaking, white, male, heterosexual, the trifecta of privilege. And he is an amazing, amazing educator for all kids, but specifically for multilingual kids. And so he actually reaches out to parents, to other teachers, to find out how to translate specific key vocabulary for that unit in three or four languages that are represented most in that classroom. In that same school, this is actually taken off. There's also a middle school teacher that I'm thinking of, monolingual setting. He happens to be white, male, heterosexual as well. Look at that. Trifecta again, and they're doing the work. He actually told his kids, I went to this training with a sassy, openly gay Latino doctor named Jose, and he told us that we really needed to embrace multilingualism. And so what he told the kids is the whiteboard on the back of the classroom, that's going to be their multilingual translanguaging wall. And so now, whenever the kids identify the vocabulary that they want to be able to ensure that everyone understands, the kids actually bring back the translations in several languages. And so this back wall in a monolingual setting is the translanguaging wall, whereas in some dual language bilingual programs, I'm not throwing stones, but let me throw a bombazo, we don't even have that. But yet, in a monolingual setting, we do. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, I think it really speaks to the power of self-awareness and self-reflection on the impact that the teacher can have on whether or not that classroom is welcoming to diverse students.
Yeah, and you know, so much is access to professional development that really targets that, right? So the C6 biliteracy framework really is for everyone. It was conceptualized to lesson plan for dual language programs, but it's being used all over the world in monolingual settings, because why couldn't we all lesson plan through an equity and social justice lens? And so it's so amazing to see teachers really embrace it. And then the other thing that I do want to mention, because I'm sure that your listeners are like, yeah, well, I don't have that. Well, yeah, part of it is that we need access to quality training. And then it's not just about drive-by PD. Like, I do have to say and be transparent that in the schools and districts where we see the most growth, it is about professional development, but then it's about follow-up. And so in some of the schools that I'm telling you that this work is happening, our team may have done 2 days of PD, which is not a lot. But then what's key is that in order for that professional development, for those strategies that are inclusive to make it into the classroom, then one of the things that really helps is the coaching, because as a teacher, I can go to an amazing 2-day PD, but I need help, you know, in how does it look like? What does it feel like and sound like in the classroom? And so in these schools where we are doing such deep work, we actually go back and coach not just the teachers, but also the administrators, so that administrators then become the biliteracy instructional coaches. And isn't that what we all want? Don't we all want, whether we're in a monolingual setting or whether we're in a dual language or bilingual setting, all of us want a principal, first of all, who is an instructional leader, not a building manager. And we want a principal that walks into our classroom and says, I love your language objective. Look at you. First, you connected. You used the 4+1 action verb. Second step, you connected it to the standard. And third step, you included an interaction. Look at you. Snap, snap. See you during recess or whatever. Like, that's what we want from a principal.
Mm. Yes.
So I just wanted to mention that because it doesn't just happen by chance. Mm. You can pick up some things from social media. You can pick up some things from a conference. You can pick up some things from a webinar or from a podcast. But for the work to really become systemic, for the work to really scale to the entire school or the entire district, it has to happen in a strategic and very planned way.
A concern that teachers have in terms of meeting the needs of multilingual students and their families, especially in our region, is this. They say, we only have one or two multilingual families in our district. What can we do to connect with the kids in school and the families outside of school? And I want to add on to that, what can we do to amplify their voices without tokenizing those families?
I love that you used the word tokenizing. Mira, mira, that was a bombazo on your part. You're throwing bombazos too. I think that there's definitely a danger in that when we don't have a lot of families that are multilingual. But I'm going to go back to where we started. If the work really is about sociocultural competence, then it goes beyond just those two or three families where language multilingualism is the norm, because I'm sure that there are also some LGBTQ families. I'm sure that there are also some families that pray or don't pray in a way that's different. And so to me, it goes beyond just those two or three families that need access in terms of language. I think that when we do the work, the true work, then it goes beyond those. And so then it's not about having a token family, because it really is about all of those families understanding that we're going to amplify many voices, and that collaboratively, collectively, we're going to disrupt the hell out of the system, because that's what we need to do.
You talked earlier about how, although we're not physically strapping kids to gurneys now, we continue to do that in metaphorical ways. And although research proves that multilingualism has major cognitive benefits, there are still people whose first thought is, like you mentioned earlier, like, oh, what does this kid lack? What gaps are there that I have to fill or replace or fix? What do you say to educators who have that as their initial reaction, that fear or stress or uncertainty?
I mean, that's so tough, right? Because it's all connected to what we've been chatting about. Part of the problem is that not every teacher has access to education, even teacher prep programs. One of the things that we used to talk about at the Center for Applied Linguistics is the fact that for teachers serving in monolingual settings, it's a very small percentage of teachers that are required to take even more than one class as a teacher in a teacher prep program in terms of serving multilingual learners. And actually, it's usually like a special POPs class, a special populations class. And so in one semester, you learn, I'm doing the little air quotations, listeners, you learn how to serve gifted and talented students with special education needs, emergent multilinguals. Like, we just have not done at the university level well by our students that have diverse needs. So that's one of the pieces. And then the second part, I think that a lot of it has to do with professional development in terms of how to serve our multilingual learners. Once we are in the classroom, like, you could ask one of the teachers at Bombazo Time, ¿verdad? For my New York friends, mm-hmm. Like, you could go into a classroom and say, so please tell me about your lesson planning process. And they're going to be like, oh yeah, we meet as a grade level. And then we share activities. And you're like, yeah, no, but how do you lesson plan? well, you know, we share activities. And I'm like, baby, that's not in a heteronormative way. That's not misogynistic, just baby in a sassy gay way. baby, that's not lesson planning. Like, when does your team plan your content, your language, and your culture objectives? No, we don't do that. I'm like, okay, well, then that's where we need to focus on, because what we as teachers can do is really tighten up how we lesson plan. It's so funny because at the secondary level specifically, I hear a lot, and I can say this because I've been a secondary teacher and administrator, I hear teachers say sometimes like, well, it's just that I'm a content expert. And I'm like, no manches, you're not a content expert. You're a content and a language of your content expert. You're welcome. So what language supports are you providing? Well, I don't. I just write my content objective. And so then I realize, okay, well, that's our starting point. Because we have to remember as educators, and I don't know that we realize this or not, but as teachers, if we are creating content objectives without language objectives, then we're asking kids to find targets in the dark. Like, we literally become the oppressor every time we ask kids to learn something, whether remote or face-to-face, without actually providing the linguistic support. And that's not just for our kids that are identified as language learners, that's for every child. Like, teachers sometimes don't understand, not because we're bad, but because no one shared the information, that the way that each one of us learns anything is by practicing listening, speaking, reading, writing, and making cross-linguistic connections. And if we share that with kids, then that's the key, because then we can hold them accountable for the language objective, because the language objective is my way of reaching that content objective. So those are some of the things that we talk about in training and that I share all the time, because it's those little steps that really get us to the next level.
I love that. And it reminds me of a moment in a conversation I got to have with Dr. Oki Lee from NYU about doing science and using language, and how knowing English is not a precursor to doing science or doing any content. They go hand in hand. They cannot be separated. And I think it's so important for teachers to hear that, especially the content expert teachers. And now it's my turn to use the air quotes, because
yeah,
I think they don't realize the power that they have to build upon the language that they do know around the content that they teach.
Yeah. So confession time, for me, I am Catholic, but I think confession time is good for anyone, right? Non-denominational. I think one of the things that keeps me so energized is that I look back upon my teaching career, and I was a teacher for a long time before I became an administrator. And I was a pretty good teacher. Like, I was like a solid B+ on 90% of the days. And sometimes I like even got into an A-. But I wasn't explicit in the languaging in my classroom. And it's one of the things that still kind of haunts me. And I just didn't know better. I wasn't privy to that research. I wasn't privy to that professional development. I wasn't privy to that information. And I feel that I did a good job because I was engaging and had my kids talking and reading and writing. But oh, how I wish that I could go back and do the things that I know now with those kids. I feel like they still love me because, you know, they follow me even now. But I think it's one of the things that connects me to the work, because I just want to make sure that teachers have access to the information that is going to help them better meet the needs of all of their students, but specifically those that we've, you know, screwed over.
If our multilingual families and students happen to be listening to this episode today, what would you say to them?
I wish that I spoke many languages. Oh, I only speak English, Spanish, and a little bit of French, and I've learned some words and phrases in Chinese because I serve a lot in Asia, but I'm sure that I would have translation, right?
Yep.
And devices. I would tell them, you know what, a lot of the information that you've heard as multilingual families is incorrect. Les diría, no se van a confundir sus estudiantes. Your kids are not going to get confused. No les vas a enseñar el español en casa. You're not going to teach French or Arabic or Mandarin at home, because that is not the way that language is learned. language, if we really want our kids to be bilingual and biliterate, has to be taught through content. It has to be languaging through content. No, but it's just that they're going to get behind. No, they're not going to get behind. If we allow kids to learn multiple languages through content, then we really are doing what is best for our kids. I have a lot of parents that in Spanish have asked me, pero, Dr. Medina, es que vinimos a los Estados Unidos para aprender el inglés. Like, we came to the United States to learn English. And then I respond in Spanish, and I tell them, no, señora, no vino a los Estados Unidos para aprender inglés. Vinieron a los Estados Unidos para crear acceso de educación para sus estudiantes. Y el único modo en el que van a poder sobresalir todos los obstáculos es ser multilingües, y no solamente en la casa, pero aprendiéndolo en la escuela. And I think that that makes a big difference when parents understand how language is added, when they know that there isn't academic and social language separate from one another. Like, that makes such a big difference. And then, you know, I like to add a little bit of sass. Like, I had one mom when I was a principal that said, yo le voy a enseñar el español en casa. I'm going to teach him Spanish at home. And I was like, really? Tell me about it. Like, what curriculum are you going to use? How are you going to make cross-linguistic connections? No, de veras, cuéntame. Oye, ¿y cómo vas a poner las tablas de anclaje? ¿Y el horario cómo va a ser? And then she was like, ay, señor Medina. Y dije, pues me dijo que le iba a enseñar el español. Así es que yo estoy esperando la mejor educación del mundo. In other words, what you want to say is that you do want to accept dual language services, sign right here, because that's how we really empower parents to make the appropriate decisions. You know how I talk about the front office? Mm-hmm. The front office is so very important because remember, they're the ones that actually help parents fill out the home language survey. Mm-hmm. If a family comes in and says, English, and you know that they need support, and they're your front office defenders of equity and social justice, you know who should know how language is added and the benefits of multilingualism? The front office staff. Because as soon as a parent says that they want to deny services, that secretary, who really is a hero in disguise, needs to say, but no, let me talk to you about the three goals of multilingualism. Goal number one, bilingualism and biliteracy. Let me tell you what that means. Goal number two, grade level academic achievement in both program languages, and then explain. And goal number three, sociocultural competence, because you're a mess, your husband's a mess, your children are a mess. But in multilingual education, we're all going to work on it. Aren't you glad that you came to this school? Sign right here, dual language it is. Like, that's what needs to be happening.
I really love the uplifting of our front office staff, because I feel like they do so much and they want to do so much for all the families who are part of our schools. And I really think that we don't do a great job of supporting them. And I appreciate you bringing them up, because they deserve to have as many learning opportunities as every other professional in the school building.
Absolutely. They're super, super important. And the ones that are a little bit testy, it's just because they didn't know. But once you engage in sociocultural competence, they're going to be like, hola, no hablo español, but I'm trying. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. Oh, we've talked about a lot of things.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm a
no,
mess.
We were you're, like not, all over the place, you're not right? allowed to say sorry. No, I love it. It's all so important and interesting and moving. And I want to know, what's one thing you would challenge our listeners to do right after hearing this episode that will amplify the voices of multilingual families or just diverse families in general? Because we know that everything you're saying applies to so many kinds of kids, not just multilingual families.
Absolutely. I think the first thing that I would do is I would go ahead and take a look at the four ways to really make sure that the lessons that I'm planning really are working towards sociocultural competence and critical consciousness. That's something that we can all do. Like, take a look at what you're going to be teaching next week and see, am I doing one of these four things? And I'll repeat them. The first one is, am I amplifying the voices of marginalized communities? The second one, am I connecting to the student or to real world? And the third one, am I leveraging the entire linguistic repertoire? Am I focusing on those cross-linguistic connections regardless of educational setting? And then the last one, am I really demonstrating or working to ensure that kids understand that social and academic language are equally important? And we can't just stay with number three and number four. Like, if we feel comfortable with cross-linguistic connections and with academic and social language, and we stay there, then you're still an oppressor. Eh? Ya lo dije. I said it. Like, we need to actually work the four into all of the work that we do every single week.
Thank you. I think that there are so many practical things that you've described that teachers can really attach onto and bring back to their own reflection practice and to their own lesson planning and their conversations with their principals, that really make this topic a little more concrete, especially for teachers who don't have a lot of experience with multilingual families.
I'm so glad.
Where can people find you? Where can people find information about your work or the services that you and your team provide? Where can we locate you?
Sure. So the website is www.drjosemedina.com. So drjosemedina.com. My email is jose@drjosemedina.com. All of the session descriptions are there, the coaching, the PD, admin work, all of that is there. And then several administrators requested a while back if I could do like 2.5 minute mini PDs that they could use in their faculty meetings. And so I actually did that. So every Monday, that's how hashtag Medina Monday messages came about. Every Monday, I target like one strategy or one piece of research or something to consider. And it's 2 minutes and 20 seconds because that's how long videos can be on Twitter. I posted on Twitter. The Twitter handle is Jose Medina Jr. 89. That's Jose Medina Jr. 89. That's the year I graduated from high school. On Instagram, it's Jose Medina 1000. And I share those things there. So I share tons of stuff. The other thing that I do is prior to COVID-19, when I visited schools, I take a lot of pictures so that you have tons of examples of what things should look like, whether you're in a monolingual, bilingual, or dual language setting.
Awesome. And we will link to all of the sites and information that you just shared when we share the blurb for this episode, so people can find it right there. Dr. Medina, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. De veras. Thank you.
It's just really special to get to have a conversation with someone who cares so deeply about all students and making sure that children and their families are known to educators. I think that it sometimes feels rare. So when you encounter it, I think it's really moving. So thank you.
Gracias a usted. Gracias por la oportunidad. I had a blast, by the way. You're very good at this.
Thank you very much. I'm learning as I go.
Thank you. Hablamos pronto. Un abrazo.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guests we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please find those on our webpage. This podcast is produced by Midstate Arburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Sunbeam from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.